Om Shanti, and good afternoon. Warm welcome to Brother Ken. Brother Ken has been in Gyan since 1975, worldwide experience. Brother Ken is originally born in Australia, but to Gyan in London. And serving in South America, he is the coordinator for the South American countries. Brother Ken has a very beautiful approach to meditation through practical experiences, a business approach, and humorous. So Brother Ken has always expressed his love for Baba through writing songs and singing. I always remember Brother Ken for that and very beautiful words that he puts onto paper and sings for Baba with lots of love. So he said he only sings for Baba, no one else. So Brother Ken, if we request a song, will you sing for us? So also Brother Ken's speciality that he has written about 13 books. He has written the books in Spanish and Portuguese and then translated that into English. So a great ability of speaking English, Spanish, Portuguese, and I think French too, Brother Ken. So this evening our topic is how consciousness affects our reality. And so thank you very much. And
thanks. Wow, that was quite an honor to listen to you. Don't know about my throat though, I've got a bit of a cold. This topic fascinates me. As I've been working on a book as a follow-up to Pathways. On the cycle. And I finished it actually, but in Australia they wanted to produce it as a standalone book, not related to any other books. Now, it's a bit of a challenge because you had to reword everything and to make it appropriate, because the knowledge that we have of the cosmology of things is very unique and completely different from anyone else. I mean, who else says that there's a cycle that repeats every 5,000 years and that's it? So Baba's knowledge, of course, is very different. I mean, why would he come and say the things that everyone else has been saying? And it was very interesting. I mean, the process of doing this book has been very interesting, because you come across, you know, at least the way that you argue with people is you say, look, there is a third alternative to the explanation of things. Because otherwise you've got the Big Bang, which was like, you know, billions of years ago, everything was condensed into a small point and then a sort of exploded, and they can note that the universe is expanding. And it is. The universe expands for some reason. But there is another way of looking at that. Maybe it's like, goes like this and then like that, you know. It expands a little bit and contracts a little bit. Just because it's expanding now doesn't mean that it's always minic. This is the big mistake that they make. And the other explanation is that God created everything out of nothing, like abracadabra, and everything appeared. And Baba comes along, and in fact this is the thing that attracted me in the beginning. It was the understanding. It was like, this is the missing piece. This is it. This is the thing that connects everything. And in the scientific world, they look for a sort of an underlying theory that explains everything. They actually call it the everything theory. And we know that there is an explanation for things. But the way we offer it to people, we offer it as, you know, this is a different way of looking at it. This is another way of looking at the same thing. But the difficulty with the scientific worldview is that there's time and space and matter and energy, these four things. And consciousness somehow arises out of those four things. This is what they say, and they can't explain consciousness. I mean, the science is created on the basis of consciousness, but consciousness is not explained by science. So it's a huge paradox. And we look at the world and even, you know, quantum mechanics and things like that. You could say that by going deeply into matter, they've reached like the beginning point of spirituality. Because if you look at it, matter must become more and more and more subtle. And then, you know, there's a connection between the souls and consciousness and what's going on. Can you imagine how subtle it is, the connection between a metaphysical energy, which is the soul, and the physical body? What sort of a connection is it? Must be incredibly amazing. And how the soul sits here, and why the soul comes into the body after 4 or 5 months of the pregnancy of the mother. Because before that, this very subtle connection is not ready. You know, you don't sit in a car when there's just a driving wheel. There has to be at least a place for you to sit. So we understand that the soul comes, connects with the physical body in a unique way. And when it's finished doing its stuff, interacting and, you know, settling things with this one and that one and interacting with matter in a peculiar and specific way, then it leaves. And the matter sort of dissolves. So it's very interesting to understand where people are coming from one side, and what Baba says on the other side. Because on this side, they're trying to understand the subtleties of matter and how it works. And then Baba comes along and says it's not only consciousness, it doesn't have a part in it, it's the fundamental part. Because though in our Muli notebooks we write down, yes, Sato, Rajo, Tamo, you know, very nice. Intellectually, we can understand, but what is the implication of that? What is the implication of how a Sato, Pradhan, intellect, consciousness interacts with the matter that produces a golden age, for example? And Baba said, for example, in the golden age, matter is extremely light. You know? Sorry, gold is extremely light. I studied chemistry, yeah? And of course, when I did this bit of physics in my chemistry course, I couldn't understand quantum physics at all. It's too bizarre. Too strange. But later on I could start to see, well, it's pointing towards the subtlety where spirituality starts, right? So you look at matter. First of all, matter's basically empty space. If you can imagine 99 followed point, 99 point followed by 13 nines, that's how much empty space there is in an atom. There's hardly anything substantial. And even if you go into the substantial part, it's also got subparticles. So it's It's incredible to think about, you know. You've got, if you, you remember your school days, when in the old days they had a sort of a model of an atom, where you had a nucleus and some electrons spinning around it. Do you remember that? It's not true. They're vibrating. Actually, matter's like a huge vibration, in a sense. And giving this illusion of form and substance. And the empty space, in Baba's language, he would call it the ether, the fifth element. I mean, we know about the other four, right? Fire, earth, air, water. They're pretty clear. But the fifth one, what is it? Yakash, what is it? Now, the quantum physicists say that matter forms because of the information that is there in the empty space. Now, who or what puts the information there? What do you think? It's consciousness. There's always been conscious beings in this universe. And there's always been matter. And there's always been time. And there's always been space. And there's always been energy. They're completely connected. Inseparable. And as consciousness goes through its stuff, it affects the other four, time, space, matter and energy. Yeah? It affects. So when the soul is satupradhan, those four things are okay. And as the soul goes through, it loses power. It's not that matter and energy gain power, but there are two very crucial moments in the cycle. One is at the end of the Silver Age, and the other is at the end of the Iron Age. Right? How could suddenly people have lost it at the end of the Silver Age? Suddenly there are earthquakes. Suddenly there's confusion. So things were going along because the souls had the conscious energy. The souls were emitting such a good vibration. In the beginning it was satupradhan vibration, then a sattva, which is a Silver Age. And then when it reached the point where it could not hold the structure together, it shattered. It shattered. And it was like, you know, I guess the second half of the cycle was put into motion. It wasn't suddenly, you know, it wasn't that gradually, we became more and more impure. There was a moment when we lost it. There was a moment when that incredible world that was still there at the end of the Silver Age couldn't retain its purity. It was like the shattering of a crystal. And something must have happened pretty grave, because the earth, the axis of the earth, you have the magnetic axis and the geographical one, and there's a distance of 22 degrees, which is, you know, that's about this much. Right? About that much. So you've got the magnetic field rotating on one sort of axis, and the actual geographical axis, a different one. So magnetic field is sort of going like this. That was not like that in the Golden and Silver Age, right? So something very drastic must have happened at the end of the Silver Age. And then suddenly, you know, people can't keep it. And they say, well, we look at science and technology today, there's been marvelous progress. But in fact, It's only since the beginning of the Copper Age. Because in the Gold and Silver Age, you didn't need agricultural science. You didn't need to know how to plant things because there was abundance, natural abundance. You didn't need medicine because no one got sick. So when people started to get sick for the first time, let's try this one. Maybe these leaves here can help me. I cut my leg, let's put these leaves on top to stop it from bleeding. And they suddenly discovered, the progress in medical sciences from that. There was no medical science in the first half of the cycle because it wasn't necessary. And the same with everything else. You think we needed to bust our brains to try and get to make energy out of something? No. I mean, if you look at the way they do things these days, 1 litre of gasoline, actually to get 1 litre of gasoline in your car, you've already spent about 9. Because to drill down, to bring it up to the surface, to take it to the refinery, to refine it, stick it in big ships and carry it all over the planet, then you drive down to the gas station to put 1 litre of gasoline in your car. You spend 9 to get 1, which is pretty, and we think we're smart. In the Golden Age, how was the use of energy, huh? Probably Baba says it's a refined form of atomic energy. So we understood how the atom actually works. And it was a natural sort of understanding. Matter served us. It stopped serving us when we started to try to serve ourselves, actually. That's what happened. But matter, we didn't break our heads to make energy. Even if you can remember back, you sit in your Viman and you think and it goes. And it goes where you want to go. You want some fruit? It's there. And we spent 2,500 years just rolling along. Everything was beautiful. And we were beautiful. It was the highest time. And I was talking to this brother this morning about, I really, when I look at the pictures of the Golden Age, they're so garish, so, grotesque. That's the attempts of artists in the Kali Yuga to represent what the Golden Age deities were like and how they were, I don't imagine, and we were walking around with all of that, those things on us, the jewels and so on. Okay, maybe on special occasions, but normal household gear probably did not include a crown. Just walking around in the garden, we probably didn't walk around with crowns on. So there's a lot of romance, there's a lot of mixture from the path of devotion. Not only when we try to portray God to ourselves, even though Baba says one thing, there's an overlay of devotion that God may not be. The Baba that I actually meditate on may be a mixture of what I think he is and what he really is. You think? What do you think? It's a mixture. Baba even says, very few children know me as I really am. So I have to remove all of my ignorance, all of it, to get the real connection. So if I've got a mixture of ignorance and gyan, I will get a partial connection and therefore not the current necessary to make the transformations that I need. So these things are, you know, quite amazing when you think about it. So if I'm trying to visualize myself in the Golden Age, it's much more of a feeling. Put aside all of this bhakti overlay, and try to feel what it's like, you know. I can definitely relate to the purity and the innocence and the naturalness and the ease. And the other day I was sharing the lack of vocabulary. No words are. There's no words for anything, you know. You don't have adjectives. None. No adjectives. And so that removes at least half of our dictionary, right? You don't have a word for great or good or bad or beautiful or fantastic or marvelous. Nothing like that. And the words themselves, you know, it's not that the roses are saying, hey, I'm a rose, you know. Things are. They don't need to be named. Naming came along when we're trying to work out things. We invented words to describe a reality that can't be described by words. Yeah? Yeah. So that's why when Baba comes along, he says things that are so simple, we want to complicate them, you know. But wait a minute, Baba mustn't be saying like, he must be meaning this, you know. So, no, you are souls. You are my children. Very simple words. You could Baba's words in them all. They're very simple. And we complicate it. You know, just have a look at your own vocabulary. How many of the things that you say and think would actually exist? And you remove everything, all of this stuff that's the accumulation of 63 births. Of bashing, you know, trying to work things out. And we come to Baba sort of broken and bruised and sort of, you know, not feeling so great about ourselves, and he wants to pick us up. And we try to complicate it. It's not, Baba must think it's so amusing, right? He actually says that. Children, I was the other day sharing that we were in one of the small meetings with Bap Dada in the early days in the history hall, some double foreigners there. And Baba looked at us and said, you people think too much. You people think too much. We do, don't we? We need to think so much. Just when you see this incredible cosmos that Baba describes, it makes so much sense. And you know, these two moments that I mentioned before, the end of the Silver Age and the end of the Iron Age, what do you think the reason is that we don't find any Coca-Cola bottles in the Golden Age? Because glass takes a huge amount of time to decompose. Probably, I don't know, thousands of years. If you just left glass decomposing, it would take thousands of years. And we don't find any Coca-Cola. Actually, there's nothing left from the Iron Age in the Golden Age. Nothing. And you think if the destruction was so thorough that everything had to absolutely disintegrate, that would be the annihilation, totally. There would be total annihilation. So if the souls who give birth to the reality that is the present time as they're going through the cycle, you know, those souls in their stage, Sato Rajo Tama, are producing the world around them. They are present, the world is like that. When they're not here, the world cannot exist as per the souls that are around. So if the souls are not here at the destruction, most go home, right? So if they're not around, the things that their consciousness shapes can't exist. Can't exist. Have you ever thought about this? How exactly the destruction happens? How exactly the golden age starts? It's like a reboot. The whole cosmos is rebooted. You know? And the souls that are around are giving, you know, Baba says, in other words, he says, when you are pure, you require pure bodies. You require a pure world. That's enough. But to actually understand how that happens, wow. That's huge implications there. Now, if gold is light in the golden age, everything that's lighter than gold must be lighter still. Yeah? So how would our bodies be? Would they be sort of dense and gross like the present ones? Probably not. We know that the hormones work differently. Like men, for example, don't have beards in the golden age. So the hormones are different. And to have, for example, pure birth, in which consciousness plays a huge role, right? The actual procreation is not done physically. It's done mentally. Huge implications. But it's possible. Because, why is it possible? Because everything always has been connected with the state of our consciousness. So we live in the world, which in fact is each one of us. This world is actually coming out of our sanskars. Yeah? Because the sanskars are producing the information into the empty space, into the, you know, the information is being put there in matter forms. It's not that we create the other people or we create the matter itself, but we shape it. We shape our relationships and we shape the matter according to how we are, individually and collectively. Makes sense, doesn't it? You know, what is the world? If you go right down to the details, people complain about the traffic, right, in most cities. Most of them were the founders of that place. And they were the ones that actually decided on building the roads like that and making cars and stuff like that. So they're getting their own back, isn't it? So people that complain about, and in fact it's like that too, isn't it? When people, their first birth, most people hang around with the same group of souls right throughout the cycle. And if it's just a few births, they probably don't go very far from that village or that town. So they just, you know, the father becomes the son and the mother becomes the boss and the boss becomes the cousin. Like that. It's just a rearrangement of the same souls. Yeah? I mean, I'm just saying these are just things that you can glean from knowledge. Isn't it? Baba may not have said that exactly, but certainly if you go into the depths of it, that's what it means. Of course, why are there cities if there is enough space in the whole world? Why do people insist on living on top of each other? Why? And this is another proof that there is a connection between time, space, and energy, matter, consciousness. Because time is short and the accounts are many. So they have to shorten the time between one account and the other. So they have to live near each other. Actually on top of each other. Otherwise, why? There's plenty of space in the world. Why would you have a city with 22 million people like, well, that's where I live. São Paulo is like that. Why would you have a city like Delhi or Bombay or even, you know, Moscow? Why would you have such an incredibly inefficient means of getting around? Everyone's sitting in their little sort of, most cars have only one person in it, you know. And they're all complaining about the traffic. They forget that they're also part of it, right? They complain about the cars in front of them, but they forget that they're in front of other cars. Yeah? So anyway, on a let's say that's maybe the macro explanation, but on a personal level, the world that forms around me comes out of me. So when I go to work, I go to work here. Then I go home, I go here. Then I go to the centre, I go here. There is actually a physical place. But mostly we're visiting the place that only exists in our own mind. That's why if you've got five people living together in a house, how many houses are there? Huh? Six. There's a house of each one, and the house as it really is. So how many people go to your center? 20? 30? How many centers are there? The number of people plus one. The one that Bubba sees, right? The one that is the real one, without any stuff. So I have to be detached. Actually, detachment means to see the things as they really are. Attachment means to see the things as I am. That's the difference. So I'm interacting with a world. Let's say I have a problem, an obstacle. Where's that obstacle? It's coming out of my sanskars, right? Sanskars are connected with karma, right? Actually, karmic accounts are sanskaric accounts. Really? Yeah? So it's, you know, I determined that I had to, you know, I don't know, that I had to have suddenly some serious problem with my health. Where did that come from? We saw there was I, for example, I almost left my body in 2004. I had a hemorrhaging form of dengue fever, which is like fatal. In 90% of the cases, it's fatal. Not the normal dengue. Dengue is like a mosquito that bites you. But the hemorrhaging form means that you come up in blotches all over you. And there's nothing that reduces the fever, actually. So I was with, what, 9 days with 39 degrees fever. So I almost departed. So I wouldn't have been here today talking to you. But then I said, oh, well, was that mosquito? No. I must have invoked it, right? My sanskars called out, hey, mosquito, come and bite me. So that's how karma works, isn't it? We invoke situation. And it's a connection between my consciousness and the reality that forms around me. You know, it's very difficult to understand. You have a difficult relationship with someone. The difficulty is in your head. Maybe the other person also thinks it's difficult. But the difficulty is in that person's head. Yeah? So if there's a conflict, say, and you go up in front of a judge and the judge says, you are 30% responsible for this and you are 70% responsible for this. In fact, I'm 100% responsible for my 30%. And the other one's 100% responsible for his 70%. And I can't change the 70% of the other. And I can totally change my 30%. So, detachment means actually to see the things as they are. Without any colouring. Without any feelings, actually. The word viragya actually means, you know what it means from the Sanskrit? It means drying up your passion. Your passion is dried up. So it means dispassionate. We translate viragya as disinterest. But in fact it means that you don't have any passion anymore for that particular thing. A little bit stronger than disinterest. You know. But, so our passions get dried out. Because, you know, I understand, for example, that what has value and what doesn't have value. That's what detachment is. Understand what really has value and what has no value at all. And I can't see that if there's any sort of mixture from my side. It doesn't matter who you're thinking about. You know. If you can look at people, the ones that you get along with, and the ones that you don't get along with, and you can see them with exactly the same feeling of love, no difference. Then that's detached love. But if you divide your world into the things that are your favourites and the things that are not your favourites, then you're still living in the Copper Age or the Iron Age. You know, people look for someone in their lives, right? Everyone wants a companion. Everyone would like a companion. Of course, we try to substitute our yearning for companionship through having a very strange relationship with an incorporeal point of light. But if we really ask ourselves, who am I looking for? I'm actually just looking for myself. When I was looking for peace, I was looking for my peace that I'd lost. When I'm looking for love, I'm looking for my love that I lost. When I'm looking for happiness, I'm looking for the happiness that I lost. So it's actually the second half of the cycle, looking for the first half of the cycle. Yeah? And Baba helps me to find myself. That's his job. And I have to become the best me that I can possibly be. That's all I have to do. I can't be anyone else. I don't have to be anyone else. I just have to be a good me. Yeah? So, you know, these are, and when we look at the am I producing, therefore, a Sattva Pradhan world now? Is my interaction with the world around me and matter actually time, space, you know, running around like a maniac, always under pressure to get things done? These are Rajo Pradhan Sanskars, Rajo Sanskars. You know, from the system. Actually, Baba didn't invent the idea, he probably did actually, but the references to it from Bhakti are very strong. and comes from the last cycle for sure. But sattva means the sattvic element, sattuguni, that means light, easy, natural, elevated, pure, fantastic, marvelous, fine. Everything works naturally. That's sattva. Raja means stress. A lot of movement. A lot of dynamism. You know, moving around, doing this, doing that, going here, going there. Trying to make things happen. So, in the sattva stage, things happen naturally. In the raja stage, you're trying to make things happen. In the tamo stage, everything happens to you. You know. Because the tama means stopped, stagnant, lethargic, you know, polluted, impure, not working. So if any of you look at your list of connections and relationships, is it light, easy, natural, wonderful, marvelous? Is it sort of tense and sort of strenuous? Or is it sort of stagnant and smelly? And that's a sattva raja tamo connection with someone. You can make your list. What about your body? Is it easy? What about service? Is your approach to service creating things up from your stage? Making, you know, creating things naturally, things just flow? Or you know, in service, sort of running around like a chicken with his head cut off sometimes. Try to make things happen, to create a program, do this, do that, do this. This is raja. In fact, if you go by the classification in food, it's the same. Food, when it's really sattva, it's like flour, fruit and flowers, and then leaves. And then, you know, other vegetables that grow above the ground. And then at the border of sattva and raja, you've got vegetables that come from beneath the ground, like potatoes and carrots and stuff like that. Food that's very spicy and tasty and sweet is raja food, according to the Lockheed classification. So I'm wondering why so many Brahmins are running around. Maybe it's because a lot of the food they eat is raja. Whether it's made with its taste in mind, and not made with the spiritual energy in mind. That's the difference. So if you're making food thinking about this is going to be really tasting great, you've made something that could be sattva. Raja. Of course, tama means things that you shouldn't eat, really, as a yogi. So all of this is, you know, part of the same idea. Things are flowing, easy, nice, natural. And the world around you that forms easy, nice, natural, you've probably got a more sattva connection with it. But if there's a lot of tension and stress and movement, you've got a raja connection with your world. And if everything's sort of, you know, difficult and horrible and nasty and smelly and vicious, then you've got a tamo connection. So what do you want? What do you want? If I were sattva, really, what would I think about people? What would I think about things? What would I think about service? If I were really sattva, how would my connection be with Baba? You know, easy. Because we're sort of sitting at the top of the peak, the top of an iceberg, right? Icebergs have 10% visible and 90% below the surface, but the individual iceberg is like a part of 1% visible and 99.9% not visible. You know. And here I am thinking that my reality will be based on that little bit of 1%. It's not realistic. Not possible. So in the same way that our physical vision is limited, for example, we only see 3% of the electromagnetic spectrum. We can't see anything after violet or anything before red. 3%. We don't see gamma rays, we don't see X-rays, we don't see microwaves. Nothing. You realize we're sitting here and we're being bombarded by 10 million gamma rays every second? Do you realize that? God, if we could see them, we'd be sort of absolutely horrified. But that's happening. So we think that the world we see, even dogs can hear better than us, right? Dogs can smell better than us too. Some insects can see better than us, like a fly. I mean, they don't see the shape, but they see movement much more quickly than we do. That's why if you want to kill a fly, of course we're non-violent, right? But if you ever wanted to do it, you're swatting a fly. You think your hand is going fast. The fly is sitting there watching your hand in slow motion. What does he think he's going to do? He's trying to kill me? Ah, let me get out of here. So you see, we think that we know. We think we know people. We don't even know ourselves. How can I know someone else? You know? How can I define someone else? This person is like that for sure. He is this. No. If I really want to be detached, I have to go to my internal gallery where I've got people, you know, and things sort of classified and labelled. I've got to remove all of the labels and let people and things be as they are. Yeah? And then I'll probably start helping really to create a golden age world. That's how things are in the golden age. And I've got to create it here, right? Things are. I am. You know, Descartes got it wrong when he said, I think, therefore I am. It's the other way around. I am, therefore I think. Remember the days when they thought that the earth was the center of the universe? In a sense it is. You know. Probably couldn't convince Copernicus of that though. It's not the earth as the center, it's the consciousness as the center of the things that happen. It's the fundamental energy. And then everything springs out. Everything moves according to the movement in the consciousness. And it's not only us as human beings that create this habitat, all living, conscious beings. I mean, we've got nothing to do with the creation of an ant's nest. But the ants certainly do. Yeah. So all conscious beings contribute to the creation of this world. So we've got to create a new world. That means we have to have a new consciousness, right? Okay. As my throat and voice are failing, I'll leave it there, I think. Let's have 5 minutes meditation. If I said any questions, you probably, you know, anyone got any questions? No, thanks. Okay, Om Shanti. Probably lots of them. But keep your minds open and you'll see things. You'll understand things. Ask questions. Ask many questions. not to doubt, but to clarify. Go deeper. Okay, let's have some yoga. Huh? Okay.